Coming up on Digital Music Trends 181, recorded on the 1st of May 2014, a number of short interviews recorded at Ames Music Connected, in between the usual news coverage as we discuss Bloom FM's unexpected shutdown, Ardio's high-quality streams, Pandora's Q1, the upfront season, Deezer's CEO leaving, the details of Spotify's Sprint deal, Imogen Heap's glove, and much more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio and a video show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps, including Downcaster, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, and many more. And your feedback and word of mouth is essential to keep the word, to keep the show going. So make sure that if you enjoy the podcast, you do share it within your network. And this week, the show is coming a few hours later than usual. And that's because I have a really special episode lined up for you. In addition of covering the week's news, I'll be also including 8 short interviews recorded at Music Connected, which is a digital music event organized every year by the Association of Independent Music here in London. And that took place yesterday, so it's fresh off the camera, not fresh off the press, I guess. This week it's a real, real pleasure to welcome just one guest, so we can keep the news segment short and sweet. But it's a real great pleasure for the first time to welcome Chandler Coyle, co-founder of Music Geek Services, which is an artist services company based in Chicago and Nashville. And Chandler also teaches music business classes at Berklee's online courses. So hi, Chandler, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Hi, thanks for having me.
The weather okay in Chicago today?
It still feels like March,
right?
It's May today.
Yeah, here it's going back to winter. It's raining.
Yeah.
I hope the audience won't be able to hear the rain tapping furiously on my window right here. So, but it's not the best day. But yeah, it's a good day to talk about the news. There's quite a few things that have happened this week that we're going to delve into. But I kind of want to start up by talking about something that's just happened literally a few hours ago, fresh off the press, and that's the fact that the music streaming service Bloom FM, which operates in the UK, has announced out of the blue that it will stop operating. It's essentially game over for the company, and one of their key investors essentially has pulled out without notice, and they can't carry on the company without that money. So the company's blog stated that we'll keep this short because we're pretty shell-shocked. Sorry, let me just pull this up. We're pretty shell-shocked. It's game over for Bloom FM. Our investor, who's been along for the ride since day one, has unexpectedly pulled our funding. It's come so out of the blue that we don't have time to find new investment. So with enormous regret, we have to shut up shop. This is a poetically crappy turn of events, as our young business was showing real promise. Our apps and web player are looking super nice, and we had 1,158,914 registered users in a little over a year. Yep. A massive thanks to everyone that helped us get this far. We're absolutely gutted, but it's been a real pleasure. So, of course, we don't really know what the real engagement figures are behind that 1 million registered users numbers, or how many of those had upgraded to the company's premium tiers. But it's sad to see one of the few companies that were playing around with the pricing models go, at least here in the UK. They were starting at £1 per month for listeners that hadn't heard us talk about Bloom FM before on the show. £1 per month for, I think, 20 tracks that were you were able to cash on your mobile, up to unlimited for £9.99 with a £5 stopgap in the middle. So, a lot of issues here to do with price points, to do with audience. Of course, we can't tell what kind of sentiment was behind the investor pulling the plug on the service. Chandler, do you think that there is still a market here for a middle price, the sort of a lower priced streaming service that is not $10 a month or £10 a month?
Yeah, I think that you're going to see experimentation in pricing with some of the services, but it's probably not going to be services that are, smaller with funding. If you can cut off funding to Bloom FM and see them disappear overnight,
right?
It's not going to be them who can experiment, because I imagine investors are looking at the potential and saying, "That's it."
Yeah,
And so, I think we'll see Beats Music and Spotify and Deezer and the like experiment with pricing models at some point. I mean, with Beats Music going to in-app purchases with iTunes, that's sort of an experimentation, although it doesn't really help the user.
Right.
It shows that they're willing to take a cut.
Yeah, and we've seen a few studies this year as well that were showing the fact that, I mean, it's kind of like obvious, I guess, if you think about it, but a few studies that were talking about the fact that more users would be willing to pay for digital music digital music streaming services if the price points were lower. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer. A lot of more people would be interested if it was $5 or $3 a month instead. But the other thing that I was going to address is the fact that it's unusual to see a company of that size sort of disappear overnight. The investors would try and find some exit, you know, even if it's just finding a way to get rid of it or, you know, sell it off. So it's just funny to see the way that it's been put out, right?
It seems calculated in that they probably, I read your article and you thought that it might have been a plea for other sort of like rescue investing.
Yeah. Make sense, right? Because it's just weird. You know, a million registered users, even if there aren't only a small portion of those are active users, it's still a relatively large audience. And the other thing that is going to be interesting to see is how those users react to the disappearance of the company, if indeed it does disappear. Because, of course, a lot of those were pulled into the company they had a big advertising campaign here in London, at least late last year, with the billboards all over the underground and on buses. You couldn't escape it, really. Magazines. Sure. It was everywhere. So I spent a lot of money on advertising. They pulled in a lot of people that perhaps were first-time consumers of streaming services as well. So I'm a little bit worried about what kind of reactions those users may have if the service disappears, given that it was their first experience of a digital music service. You know, it doesn't look good if the first one you tried ends up disappearing within a few months, and it doesn't spur consumer confidence. So I do hope that this is just a false alarm, and hopefully the company manages to get rescued in some way. But we'll keep an eye on this, and I'm trying to reach out to management as well to see if I can get some more information on this. And we're going to introduce the first interview from Ames Music Connected now, which is with Adam Cardew, the head of digital at Absolute Marketing and Distribution. So enjoy. It's great to be here with Adam Cardew from Absolute Marketing and Distribution. So hi, Adam, thanks for joining me.
No problem.
And we're here at Music Connected. So first of all, tell us a little bit about what Absolute Marketing does.
Okay, so Absolute Marketing is a label and distribution service. So we're a label services company that's been in the game for 15 years. We work directly with artists and managers, enabling them all of the functions that a major label would offer them to bring their music to market. We work on very, very big acts such as McFly, Lisa Stansfield, Crystal Fighters, right down to acts that you may not have heard of yet, but will hear of soon. The important thing is that artists get to keep their rights all the way through.
So 15 years is a long time, because mm-hmm. we've seen the rise of label services as something that people know of. It's maybe of the last 3-4 years max.
Yeah.
And before that, people didn't really think about it. So how have you seen sort of having that extra experience come into play now that this is becoming a really big business?
So, yeah, you're right in saying that label services definitely been a buzz term in the last 3 years or 4 years. The difference being for us is that we've seen how label services has developed right from the beginning. So we know what the function is and what the idea behind it is, which is that the label works the project, and basically the artist pays the label a royalty, or the distribution company a royalty, not the other way around. So it's based around creative control, and the label services company really advising the artist on making the decisions that they want to bring to the market.
Sure, of course. Your panel today is called Breaking an Act for Under £1,000, the panel that you're on today.
Yep.
£1,000, that is, and so that's definitely a very low price point. So, do you think that's that is possible? And what do you think are the thresholds today for breaking an act in terms of potential costs and things that are must-dos for a band?
Okay, so the first thing that when an artist or a band comes to Absolute, the first thing that we do is we go through and we look at all of their different digital touch points and give them a digital health check so that we understand what they're good at, what they're bad at, where there are areas for growth. The idea of being able to break an act for £1,000 is quite a funny one, because you can't really do it.
What does it mean to break an act anyway? You know,
exactly.
Definitions are different.
The definition is something that you need to look at. So I'd like to phrase it as, how do we get the artist to the next stage of their career within a certain budget. So what we'll look at is what platforms are the artists really performing well on, or what do they really relate to, and how can we put budget behind that to get them more traction on that platform. So there's various different ways that we'll look at doing that. Obviously, you have your traditional social networks such as Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. All of them play on different levels. So if the artist's particularly good with images or video, then we'll point them in the direction of Instagram and YouTube. And then it's up to us to put the structure behind it to basically monetize and get them fans long term. If somebody was asking me if I had a blank canvas band and where would I put the money and where would I want to gain the strongest fan base, I'd want to put it all into gaining a sustainable email marketing database, one that we would own and we're not having to work with changing goalposts in terms of what it costs us to reach those fans. The reasons for that being that Facebook, there's no competition for Facebook because Facebook is Facebook. If you have a fan base on there and you decide that Facebook isn't for you anymore, then you can't migrate those fans elsewhere easily. But if you have a mailing list and you're using MailChimp and suddenly MailChimp hike up their prices, then you can switch to another provider, and that's basically what keeps the cost down of it.
Sure. And finally, you know, are you quite platform agnostic when it comes to finding the right platform for each project, and that might be different every time? Or do you have go-to places, for example, for crowdfunding that you use all the time?
Yeah, well, for crowdfunding, Absolute have a very strong relationship with Pledge Music. So Pledge is a really great platform for us to go out, and even with a very small fan base, you can put together a crowdfunded project and basically boost your pre-sale for week one chart position. I'd like to think that we're pretty agnostic in terms of which platforms we work with. We very much go on what the artist is good at and what they're willing to work with. So what I wouldn't want to do is take an artist who's very, very good at video on YouTube and try and ram Instagram down their throat. That's not going to work. So we're agnostic in that sense, but also it's very difficult for us to work with platforms that are changing the goalposts. And so that comes into our considerations as well.
And we're going to move to talking about Ardio. So Ardio's had a few interesting news coming up in the last few weeks to do with international deals. And this week we've heard news around the quality of streams. So the company has announced that it would increase the quality of music streams at 320 kilobytes per second and convert everything into AAC format without increasing prices. And it will also work with artists and label to continue to raise the bar higher when it comes to audio quality. The announcement comes as the company aligned with Bob Weir's from the Grateful Dead's initiative called Artists for Quality. His point is similar to Neil Young's in the sense that he says that digital music is tiring to listen to, and that increasing the audio quality and moving to better formats than MP3 will help people be able to listen to music for longer as well, which is something that certainly we'd like to see. And you know, this is another sort of play for quality. Spotify also streams at 320 kilobits if you select the high quality option, and they're streaming Ogg Vorbis format. I'm not audiophile. I have no idea whether that means that it's much better or worse or if it's the same. Although between AAC and MP3, there is actually a definite difference there. Mm-hmm. in quality. So, Chandler, do you think that people care about bitrate here? Is it just, you know, going to be something that people find within their everyday experience, that they're going to just hear the music sound better? Or will that actually affect in any way their decision process when selecting a music service at this point?
Yeah, I think maybe with their brand new to streaming, that may not affect it. But I know that for a certain level, like I chose Mog based on people's feedback saying you can stream at 320 when Spotify wasn't streaming. Right. At 320. So that attracted me, but I imagine that people that don't know the difference between AAC and MP3 and different bit rates may not realize it until they, you know, switch it on. So I don't know if it would attract the general person to the service, but the big concern is bandwidth. I have problems. I have a iPhone 4, which is 3G, and if I'm at the gym where I use Beats a lot, I've run into, you know, if I have it on high quality, I run into problems of stability.
Right.
So, and the other concern in the U.S. especially is usage caps that use up after 5 gigs or two and a half gigs or whatever. If you're streaming 320 kilobits and you're streaming a lot of music, you're going to hit that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I'd like to see in these bundles, they tout these bundles, is that you can stream all you want on Spotify for the money you're paying. Is it Sprint they're partnering with, or Beats and AT&T? I'll consume a lot of music if I don't have to pay, you know, if I don't have to worry about my cap.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
That, and that's a concern.
Yes, absolutely. And so we're going to have to see how that plays out in terms of the way that's delivered on a mobile network. Of course, you know, with the 4G rolling out more widely, that might be less of a concern. I mean, the other thing is also, of course, storage problems when it comes to caching some of those higher quality tracks, because the storage prices haven't really fallen when it comes to mobile phone purchases as much as they have fallen in real life when you're actually buying hard drives. So
right.
I think the iPhone has been stuck to those, you know, 16 gigs and 32 gigs and 64 gig price tiers for a long time without seeing a significant doubling up of the storage as it has done on, for example, solid state drives. So I guess this year is going to be a leap year, hopefully. We're going to see some of these devices start offering double the amount they were offering perhaps in the last 2, 3, 4 years. And that might open up the space of mobile phones also to having higher quality music on there.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the storage. I used to have an iPod with, you know, it was filled all constantly, and now I just don't want to deal with MP3s. And on the phone, the only reason I end up caching stuff is because I'm concerned that I'm going to be in an area where it's just not going to be stable until I get a newer phone. When they release iPhone 6, I'll probably upgrade, but I find that I just deal with, like, with Beats, it's go in there and listen to something. There's so much music, and the older you get, what you can choose from, if you go back to the 60s, that's 50 years of music. I don't need to cache anything. There's nothing precious to me that I must listen to it while I'm in the subway with no Wi-Fi. I just, you know, just deal with it, just get over it. And, you know, so storage, I'd rather keep my phone clean, but I know that there are some people who just need to have 80 gigs worth of their, you know, playlists local, just in case they're on an airplane with no Wi-Fi.
Absolutely, that's right. And we'll see what happens in the next couple of years when it comes to both 4G and storage on devices. And if indeed caching will play a part. And this kind of falls back into the conversation we were having about Bloom FM. I had a few people on Twitter that were remarking on the fact that they didn't think that a lower priced streaming service was necessary, because most people are just going to stream music from YouTube anyway, so what's the point in having a £1 service per month if people are just going to use YouTube anyway? So I don't know. I mean, I still feel like there is the need of some sort of caching, and I think we're still maybe a few years from, or 2, 3, 4 years from having such an amazing connection everywhere that you'll be able to just rely on streaming all the time. But I don't know, maybe I'm wrong in that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely use it. The other day I wanted to listen to a Brendan Benson album, and something led me to say, you know, like, save this so that it caches it. And I was glad, because I was somewhere where the connection was horrible, and I just switched to offline mode and listened to it. And I said, you know, it is useful. So, we are definitely not at the state where you don't need the caching.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Emily will be happy about the plug on Brandon. So.
Yeah.
And so now I'd introduce the second interview from Ames Music Connected, which is with Stephen Bass, co-founder of Moshi Moshi.
The label's got an incredible history, over 10 years of doing great work on the independent sector. Today's panel, I wanted to talk about that first, is about music and brands. On that perspective, for Moshi, what are your thoughts on the associations between independent artists and you know, independent labels and brands, and are those growing in the last few years?
We're very open to working with brands. I think we always have been, as a independent label which started, unfortunately, probably 5 years too late to be in a position to make money in the old-fashioned way. We've always had to be a bit forward thinking, so we're very open to it. I'd actually like to do more, to be honest. I'm here today with a view to trying to do more. You just have to make it work. for yourself, really. And it's always possible to do that. So, yeah, we're very open to it. The more, the better, really.
Sure. And from your label's perspective, have you had any interesting success story or interesting partnerships that have happened over the last couple of years when it comes to brands?
Maybe 3 years ago, I helped curate the RizLab stage at Best of All. I think that went really well. Certainly from my point of view, it got us a little bit of money. We got to work with some interesting artists and just enabled us to do things which we hadn't previously been able to do, you know, when we don't have the funding. I think anything that allows you to do things that you're restricted to do otherwise. We've done a couple of other bits and bobs. Slow Club did a live performance at Red Bull Studios that was streamed. We recently made some beer for our 15-year anniversary with BrewDog.
Awesome.
So just bits and pieces, and then probably more directly with the bands that we work with and manage as well. So,
and there was just a direct-to-fan panel here at Music Connected, and so the subject here is how best can artists and record labels make the most of the direct-to-fan opportunities. So what are you doing in that respect?
We have a website which, you know, we sell things on via the website, which we've been doing for quite a while now. We've actually taken that in-house recently. We also have had a subscription running for quite a few years now. I mean, maybe 7 years, where people can pay £25 or £50 a year and get everything we release digitally. So
That's
we've
awesome.
Been exploring these things. Again, I think we're very much a work in progress, Moshi Moshi. You know, I'd love to be in a position where we could bring in people to work these things as hard as possible, you know, and really exploit them. So I think the potential's there, and I know that we should be doing more. Day to day, we're pretty much just focused on working on the bands and making sure the bands have their careers, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's something for the future for us to explore more and exploit as much as we can Moshi Moshi's brand, you know, and who we can reach.
Yeah, and talking about funding, one of the interesting things that's come up in the last sort of 2 years was direct-to-fan, but from a sort of pledging perspective. So Pledge Music has come up as one of an interesting avenues for labels and artists to raise funds before the album is released or as the album is being released. So do you think that's something that might be interesting for labels that are struggling with getting enough funds to get as many artists as they'd like signed and sort of fund those releases and help shift, you know, make the economics work a little bit better, essentially?
Yeah, of course. We've done a bit of that. We've done a couple of things with Pledge, Tom Williams and the Boat, Summer Camp. We recently had a band called Babe that raised some money via Kickstarter to make a series of short films on their album. I think the model's really good. I think what I like about it is not just the fact that you're de-risking your investment by getting fans to put the money in advance. I like the fact that it requires bands to have an element of faith.
Right.
And get involved early and then hopefully become, you know, quite vocal in their support of these bands and encourage their friends to get involved, which is a sort of an old school thing that doesn't happen as much perhaps these days, seeing as everyone gets access to things so quickly and easily. So I think anything that engages an audience and makes them work a little harder to reach a band has longer lasting benefits.
Yeah, and a question I'm going to ask finally to every independent I chatted with today is streaming services pro or against at the moment, or sort of on the fence?
I'm for everything. I'm for any way of people getting music and discovering bands and engaging with bands in a legal manner that enables the bands and the labels to get paid, basically.
Exactly, that's awesome. And leave us with a couple of the upcoming releases that people should be checking out from the label.
Hercules and Love Affair album's out in May, Tellyman album's out in June, Tom Beck album's out in June as well. The Babe album came out recently and is beautiful. Marrying the Believer you should be listening to, Fimba Bravo, and of course the greatest rock and roll band in the world, The Wave Pictures.
Awesome. And check out moshimoshi.com, right?
Moshi Moshi Music.com.
Sorry about that. Thanks so much. Cheers. And so we're going to talk about Pandora now. And the company announced its Q1 earnings last week. And although it beat expectations with losses per share lower than expected at minus $0.13 per share rather than minus $0.14, it's not huge, it's not much better, but, you know, it's a little bit. And it beat revenues predictions by a cool $16.6 million. There were still concerns around its growth potential, which sent the stock plummeting for $28 per share to a low of 21 in just a couple of days, although it has now recovered slightly. So according to the Financial Times, the company, which has enjoyed constant, consistent year-over-year revenue of growth of over 50%, said that its second quarter sales would fail to match that level, rising as much as 38.5% to $218 million. So a slight decline here in growth as the company starts to really saturate the market, because there's a lot of people in the US that are listening to it. So there are a lot of factors involved in Pandora stock, of course. You know, the market is just crazy, and we can't really tell what's happening there. But this could be just an adjustment, because the stock price has gone through the roof in the last year. There's also concerns around profitability. It might become profitable towards the end of the year, but again, no certainties there. There's loads of lawsuits, including the pre-1972 rights lawsuit that's just started last week. Yep. That could also put a dampener on investors' enthusiasm around the product. And so 2014 is going to be a real test for Pandora to see if it can sustain its growth and fend off competition from other streaming services. Chandler, on your part, how do you feel about Pandora and this kind of weird roller coaster ride that when it comes to its stock price? Do you think that investors are just crazy as usual and the market doesn't make any sense, or are they responding to something that's actually happening around the company?
I think they're going through, I mean, on one hand, it's great that they're pioneers in this space and, you know, being a public company. But at the same time, all their dirty laundry is being aired with the right. lawsuits, and, you know, they're the Spotify of their space. They just can't do anything without someone protesting against them or mentioning them. So I think there's that built into the jitters on Wall Street. So if there's any negative news from their camp financially, there's less leeway for people to say, well, they'll be okay, because they're, right. Everyone's on the edge. From a user perspective, I can't listen to Pandora. I can't do a lean-in experience with Pandora longer than 20 minutes, because I use up my skips. I get bored. It's right. just it's really not well for music geeks or music, you know, like if you really like your music and you know what you want, their playlists veer off what I want too soon.
Yeah.
And so I go back to Beats, or I find Songza to be sort of in between Beats and Pandora, but
awesome.
for a lean back experience where Pandora is in the background,
right?
It's pretty awesome, and you know, the ads are a little annoying, but I haven't paid for it yet, and yeah. So that's probably a concern. As you think about it, is a lot of Pandora's users are sort of this annoyed by ads but won't pay for it mode, and you know, at some point, their growth will be inhibited, I think, by that.
Yeah. And this comes all off the back of, another piece of news, which was the fact that iTunes now has 800 million registered accounts, which is a mind-boggling number, considering that most of them have credit cards attached.
Yeah. And so, I think they have 400 million credit cards and 800 million accounts or something like that. It's ridiculous.
Wow. It's ridiculous, yeah. And so, yeah, that's always the elephant in the room, what Apple's going to do with the streaming, if anything, and how it's right. going to move in that direction. I think everybody's waiting to hear what the company's plans are on the music front. That's because I think their lunch is being eaten by Spotify, as we are going to talk about towards the end of the show as well. And now I'm going to introduce another interview from the Ames Music Connected Conference, which is with Ian Catling from the company Audio Salad.
So what's Audio Salad all about?
So Audio Salad is a content management platform for record labels, for artists and right holders. Essentially, Audio Salad can take metadata, media assets, manage them very easily, very effectively, and once they're under management in Audio Salad, we can distribute them to anywhere and anyone that a label or an artist would want to, do business with. We're an entrusted partner of Google, Spotify. We're an iTunes certified encoding house. We're integrated with over 60 third-party services. And we also have a B2B portal where any of the assets can be shared securely with press, marketing, with DJs, tastemakers. And we have an integration with Shopify for e-commerce as well. So using Audio Salad, you can basically set up a direct-to-fan store on the Shopify platform very easily, just a few clicks.
So when did the company start out, and what was the idea behind it? What was your background that sort of drove you to start
well,
it?
Well, my background was in software development and finance. I was working on Wall Street, and my partner, I was working with him at the time, and we saw a lot of changes in the financial industry that we thought, well, hang on, this is probably going to affect the music industry the same way. And we were both music fans. I was into house music, he was into rock, and so, you know, we kind of thought, why don't we take some of the skills that we've learned in finance and set up a company that, you know, works in a more fun industry. So that's where the idea was born, and you know, we quit our sensible day jobs and started to build the company out. And, yeah, it's been a fantastic journey so far.
Yeah. How did you find the music industry? Because, of course, it's far less organized than the finance industry.
So. Well, I was going to say it's disorganized, but it's exciting, it's engaging, it's I've been lucky enough to work with some incredibly smart people, some very bright, talented people, you know, every day, every week actually poses a new challenge and a new opportunity, so I find it very inspiring in a way that I wasn't particularly being inspired to continue to work on Wall Street. So.
Yeah, exactly. There's always new things to be learned in the
absolutely,
music industry
yeah,
as well.
Absolutely,
yeah. Well, it was a pleasure. And where can people find the company's website as well?
Go to audiosalad.com. And
that's available for people internationally?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to audiosalad.com, you can you know, find out more about the platform. You can get in contact with us there. And you know, we'll get right back to you.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
And there was a great story on Billboard by Andrew Hamper, who talks about how the music business is vying for a larger chunk of TV's $20 billion upfront ad dollars. So this is not a field I know a whole lot about, but apparently we're in the middle of the upfront season in the US, when media companies secure some $20 billion in early advertising buys with TV, cable, and radio networks and online content companies. So these upfront advertising buys often include events and award ceremony, but also predetermined launches of products or of music releases, for example. So the key event in this is the Digital Content News France conference in New York City, which is happening right now, right up to the 7th of May. So Vivo and YouTube have had a seat at the table for some time. And for the first time, Live Nation is going to do a big presentation this year. And Vice is also slated to present. So the issue the article highlights for music is that although the upfront remains a priority for brands looking to lock in exclusive sponsorships to major awards, events, and entertainment platforms, it doesn't really offer the flexibility needed to properly activate music fans when it comes to releases. So, for example, sponsoring an album launch is something that falls outside of this kind of marketplaces because it can't be done a year in advance. It has to be done, you know, maybe 2 or 3 months in advance, and that's a different type of timeline. So, and also there's a big part of the fact that if you want to buy into an artist, you really have to like that artist as a brand and feel like there is a connection there between you and the artist. So we are always talking about how the music industry can learn from TV in terms of and film, when it comes to windowing, when it comes to the way it sells rights. And also, I was at a conference this week where we're talking about sports and connections with sports and how the music industry should behave more like the sports industry to monetize. But the truth is that the music industry is very different from all of these industries, and it's very hard to create parallels. So, you know, from your perception, Chano, do you think that there is more of an opportunity for music to be more front and center when it comes to these big brand buys, like this, you know, $20 billion upfront ad dollars that are being put on the table each year, and how could it do so?
Yeah, well, I think there's probably opportunity for brands to advertise at smaller levels. You see a lot of it, obviously, in the big, you know, Pepsi sponsoring an artist that's touring stadiums, but I know that, like, smaller bands, or even bands that are touring 5,000 to 2,000 seat facilities, there's still a lot of opportunity for, I mean, you go to a baseball game and you see advertising everywhere. You go to a hockey game, you go to a, you know, football game over there, soccer here, and there's just billboards and everything.
Yeah.
You know, at a concert, it's a, you go to a venue and there's not a lot of advertising. I mean, there's some, you see Bud Light, they do that where they shine the light on a wall and it's got the logo and everything. But, you know, there's a fine line because sports is not art.
Yeah.
And art is dangerous. Fans get turned off by too much sponsorship. I think Justin Timberlake fans are going to, they look past that, or the sponsorship perhaps improves the experience. Wow. Lady Gaga and Doritos, you know, that whole, at South by Southwest, but it's a fine line. I think advertising, if done right, you know, it helps the artist. You know, if an artist wants to get, it's, except it's more endorsements. That's, you see a lot of endorsements. In fact, a lot right. of artists don't take advantage if they're loyal to Gibson guitars. You know, contact Gibson and see what can happen. You never exactly. know, they might have something. So, but as far as it's definitely something that the industries are different, and but.
There are opportunities there. I mean, I wanted to tap into your expertise as well. You know, as part of the Music Geek Services, you did a lot with merchandise as well. And so, you know, how do you feel artists would react if a brand came to them and said, look, if you allow us to have like a logo on your T-shirt sleeve, then we're going to pay for your merchandise to be printed, and then you cut that cost, and essentially it's all profit for you. You know, a bit like a lot of sports teams do, I guess. Do you think yeah. that some bands would be open to that?
Yeah, if the pricing on the T-shirts was lower, I think if a good T-shirt, like I go to South by Southwest and I come home with 10 T-shirts and right. the logo is on them. I'm probably wearing one now underneath this that I have no problem wearing it. But if I'm going to pay $20 for something, it would have to be tastefully done, I think. And it would probably have to be... there are some brands where it might actually be good. If Volcom
right.
sponsored a band, Volcom already does, you know, apparel.
Yeah.
So in that case, it's sort of a cross promotion between the Volcom brand and the brand, and they have a record label.
Right.
So they probably already do that. But so, you know, where there's synergy, it would make sense. And that's a good point. If there's like Red Bull, you know, if a Red Bull shirt and the shirt was significantly cheaper than the other shirts, then yeah, I wouldn't care.
Yeah,
I like free T-shirts, so I'll wear you know, I'll wear anything. But
yeah, but that's interesting actually what you said, that you know, if that happened, that would lower the perceived selling cost of the T-shirt in the eye of the consumer if there was a brand partnership involved in that, so the consumer yeah. wouldn't be willing to pay as much for a T-shirt that has a sponsor logo on it than for a T-shirt that doesn't have it. So that's
but
that's
I think what would make more sense is a brand sponsoring, or you know, paying for it, and then the band giving those away, or perhaps free T-shirt with
yeah.
purchase of vinyl LP. That would be more, you know, the fan, if a free T-shirt. If I'm going to buy an LP from a band at a merch table and get a free T-shirt, I'm going to, you know, even if the logo on the back is a big Pepsi logo, that I don't care. I'm, you know, it's the incentive. It's just sort of like at a merch table, just trying to get them to stick around there.
Yeah.
I think, and so there is an advantage if a band is giving away T-shirts or giving away anything, it attracts people to your merch table.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to actually introduce an interview from Music Connected that actually is in sync with this discussion around brands, which is with Ben Perrault, a co-founder of Syncio. It's a real pleasure to be here at Music Connected 2014 with Ben Perrault, co-founder at Syncio. So hi, Ben, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Hey, Andrew. How are you doing?
Great. And so first of all, tell us a bit about Syncio. What's the company all about?
So Syncio is a software platform that helps advertising agencies, filmmakers, games developers license music more easily. So we have hundreds and hundreds of people who work in those industries. And on the other end, we have thousands and thousands of songwriters, composers, producers, sync agents, all sorts of people who are music professionals in some way or another, and you put a brief into the cloud, and then all of the different music professionals respond, and you can pick up a great piece of sync or a bespoke license.
Awesome. So do you license the content yourself?
We're an intermediary, so our focus is how can we massively scale up the volume of opportunity for the music business, and also scale up the quality and opportunity for all of the creative industries too, because we know all this work is ongoing, but a lot of it is still happening offline, hand to hand, like through, you know, very heavy intense human capital businesses, and we think that there is a bigger opportunity to for those to exist, and for a software solution so that more of the market can flow more easily, I guess.
Absolutely. So when you're talking about artists that come onto the platform and register, so how does that process work? Is anybody able to do that, or do you select people?
Right now, it's a hand curated selection of music professionals, and we've done that because in the early stages, the product's about a year old. Just under, and we've done that because in the early stages it allows us to be very, very careful about who is on the platform and the quality of work. In the long term, we'd like to open that up more, and we're looking at a bunch of tools that will help us do that. But at the moment, you go on the site, Synkio, synk.io/apply, and it's on the main homepage too, and you can just submit an application, and then one of the team will listen to it over the course of the next fortnight, and you'll be let into the site, and you can respond to all the projects you want to. You'll receive emails when new projects go up. It's pretty straightforward, and that's the whole thing. The whole idea of the product is dramatic simplification of a relatively complex part of the music business.
So essentially, the track that's submitted is sort of to establish the ground base level of quality, and then but the work that is commissioned is actually all original.
Yeah, but it's not all original. So we use some syncs too, right? So there's a mixture of stuff happening on the platform, but the idea is as a client, so as a producer, an advertising agency, you have an opportunity to receive human chosen responses to your projects every day. So you put a product onto the platform, and then somebody has to think about what they want to respond, and then they'll submit that for your project. So rather than you sort of doing the old library search of just metadata and kind of going down the rabbit hole with like, I want it to sound like this genre with this tempo and all this kind of stuff, those are very clinical things which require you to understand how the metadata has been layered over to the top of the music. There'll be real people who'll be looking at your brief, and as a musician, you can respond to a real project and give it a human response, which, you know, music is subjective, and so that subjectivity needs to be preserved in the whole process, all the way through to the advert with the music getting played to the audience.
Yeah. So your panel that you were on just now, it was called Brands and Music in the Digital Age, and so of course dealing with sync, you deal with a lot of brands that are looking for music. How has that how did it come into Syncio, sort of what's your background, and how have you seen that relationship between brands and music evolve over the last few years? Are brands more open to getting unknown music into their process and using that?
I've seen it evolve at the audience end more than anything. So my background was, I was a music journalist for 5 years, and then I went to major broadcasters like Sky and BBC and various other organizations, and I've always worked at the most audience orientated end of the business, so either in editorial or product roles, understanding what's going on from the audience's perspective. So what I've seen change over the course of the last 15 years is audiences becoming much, much more receptive to the content, and content becoming much, much more creative. You know, you're seeing these kind of integrations happening in a much more creative way, which I think is actually beneficial to the artists, but also beneficial to the brands too, and that's partly driven by market factors, but also about, I think, people just starting to think about this space more, because it's the area of the music business that's really growing.
Yeah. And budget wise, last question, have you seen, I've heard somebody at the panel yesterday talking about the fact that they reckon the budgets, the percentage of budget allowed for music is shrinking. Do you find that's true? Is the budget for music lower? Or
I've not seen evidence of the percentage of budget shrinking for music. What I'm seeing is the volume of deals going up.
Right.
So I think the budget, allocated for music, I haven't really seen change a great deal in the very small time frame that we've been running this business. But what I am seeing is the volume of media in the world is growing exponentially. So there are more YouTube videos, more advertising channels, more games, more mobile games, more products being created which require music every day. And so as that stuff continues to grow, the opportunity exists for more and more sync and licensing to happen. And so irrespective of the value of each individual deal, the overall market is growing, and therefore the opportunities are growing, and therefore as a musician it's a great time to get involved and educate yourself about this space. And what we're trying to do is help both of those things happen.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, Andrea.
And once again, the website is
Synkio, synk.io.
perfect.
Thanks.
And there was another big news coming from one of the top three streaming services in the world, as it was announced that Deezer's CEO, Axel Dorsier, will be leaving his post in September for another, as of yet, unannounced position. So Dorsier has spent 4 years at the company, during which the service has expanded to cover most territories worldwide, excluding the US, and has raised another $130 million in venture capital money. So Dorsier was not the founder of Deezer, and so his departure won't have the same effect for example if Daniel Ek was to leave Spotify. But Chandler, do you think that this will affect how the company moves going forward, given that this market, you know, changes really quickly? Can you foresee, you know, a change of leadership at this stage in a very delicate position for Deezer to be problematic for a company of this size, and could it leave a bit of a power vacuum when it comes to making decisions?
It's interesting. I think they'll be fine, since he's not a founder, and and they're a strong brand. I mean, we're waiting to see them come into the U.S. to try them out. I'm pretty loyal to Beats right now, but you know, I tried out RDO last week a couple weeks ago for the first time, and but the thing that confused me about this Deezer thing was, did they have to announce it at this time? You know, it's like, I'm leaving in September, which is 4 months away. Were they required by some kind of, you know, business reason to announce it? And the fact that, why couldn't they wait to announce it when he could explain where he's going?
Or have found a replacement already.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of like when Ian Rogers left Topspin, there was a lot of confusion. And I know there are business reasons for hiding things like that, but then you get people speculating like we are.
Yeah.
Where's he going? Was he forced out?
Yeah.
What's the impact going to be? I think my guess is that he had an opportunity, and they were probably talking, and they said, maybe now is a good time for you to exit. Your job here is done.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's the way I viewed it. When I read the article, I'm like, okay, his job here is done. Someone else is going to be brought in to do something. I mean, that's sort of the way a lot of people viewed Ian at Topspin, was his job there was done. He was going off to do something because an opportunity came up that he couldn't turn down.
Exactly. And the other thing is also that the company was supposed to launch in the US this year. It was very bullish. Some of the executives were very bullish at the beginning of the year as to the fact that they were going to launch in the US, but so far we haven't heard a peep around that. You know, we'll keep an eye on these stories, of course. Now I want to introduce my interview with Mark Meharry, who is a CEO at Music Glue, recorded at Music Connected in London just yesterday. I'm here with Mark Meharry from Music Glue, and actually I haven't had you guys on the show before, so thanks for joining me. How's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So we'll get on Music Glue in a second, but first of all, let's talk about your panel, which was on Directive Fan. And so there were a lot of different points of view here, but for the most part, of course, it looks like on the independent sector side of things, most people are pro Directive Fan. It's just a question of how it's managed, right?
Yes, I think everyone knows that they have to do it, and the struggle at the moment is the understanding of exactly what it is. In particular, what we've found is that within the label community, the jump, and it is a jump, between being a wholesale provider to being a retailer is quite a significant shift in mentality, and whereas we've been working with predominantly managers up to now, managers, venues, festivals, which are very experienced in retail, they get it and they understand it. And they're, whereas within the label community, when we start talking about well, what is the price that you want to sell to your customer? What is the post and packaging that you want to add on? Have you considered the VAT that you have to pay for your sales and where those sales are? Suddenly you get a lot of alarm bells ringing, and that's part of what we wanted to try and communicate today, is that, hey guys, it's not that complicated, but it is more complicated than just sticking something in your whole typical wholesale model and shipping off a crate of things to a retailer who would take care of the rest of it. It's a lot to it.
Absolutely. And it feels like merchandise is kind of the unspoken topic in the music industry right now, because it's such a huge, hugely important part, but there's actually not a lot of information out there around suppliers, around how it works, and it's kind of a bit of a dark art still.
It's a massively dark art. There are a bunch of players out there. We're only now getting our heads around actually who the players are, but it has been around since the dawn of the music industry. You know, t-shirts have been part of what this industry has been about for a long time, and the money has been a way for a lot of acts to actually survive. Yeah. Now it's going onto a global scale, and retail is becoming a global thing. Fulfillment now has to happen globally. So the sourcing of these products, the creation of the products, I mean, and that's all changing a lot as well. We work with now third-party suppliers that do print-on-demand for T-shirts, which is a fascinating product in itself, which is the ability for a band to upload just a picture, pick what color shirt they want, and what quality of shirt, put a mark up and say, I want to make £4, £5 per shirt, and that's it, no stock risk. And that's with their tote bags, with their hoodies, everything. So there's a lot of changes happening in that world of merchandise to remove, and people don't, it's never really been well understood, because it can be really expensive. The stock risk element of merchandise is huge. That, you know, and so many bands that you know about will have boxes and boxes of T-shirts and CDs and all sorts of things sitting in their loft. We've got to get away from that mentality. There should never be stock sitting around. It should be well thought through. Only buy the things that you can possibly sell. But that's, again, education. And it's a slow process. People don't like change.
Sure. And we talked about direct-to-fan services on the show recently, in view of the Topspin sell-off as well, and the way that the company was split up in two halves. So do you think that there's going to be a gap left in the US there for more companies to come in and fill what they were doing, or do you think they're going to be able to maintain sort of the audience they already had?
I don't know the full details of what happened.
Sorry, I don't think anybody does exactly.
No, it's... I can guess, and we're getting a lot of work coming in from the States, especially at the moment, as people are leaving the Topspin platform. My guess is, from knowing, so you know, we've been doing this longer than they have been doing it, and that we've been slowly building. We have not done any marketing campaigns. So a lot of people don't actually know about Musical.ly, but we've got a lot of clients and some massive international superstars down to thousands of tiny clients. But we've been learning all the way on how to do this. And what we've worked out over the years, and which is absolutely fundamental, is this is logistics. This is
right.
Our business model is not like your Facebooks or Twitters or these fun, exciting things. We're Amazon, and it's that ability to take orders in multiple currencies, multiple languages, have them coming in from all around the world and then being shipped out all around the world, with tickets being delivered in the right places, the shows going on, the t-shirts arriving, the digital content arriving in the right format, in the right places at the right time, is a huge chunk of work. It's not something that any company can come along and go, I'm going to do this in 2 years and I'm going to be a startup. It's like, you're not. It doesn't matter if you had £100 million that you're going to throw at it, you're still not going to be able to build that very quickly. So unless there are players in the market right now that have actually worked all that out, I'd be surprised actually if they're going to be a lot of new players coming in. They'll come in and say that they do it.
Yeah.
Whether they actually make it work or not, and it's really important. This is an artist's career that's on the line here. When they say to their fans, if you buy it through me, it's going to work and you're going to be treated better than everybody else. If the fan then is treated worse than everybody else because the system doesn't work, that band will never work with you again. I mean, and that's fundamental.
Yeah. Finally, I left the best bit for you for last. So a quick pitch on what Musical.ly is and what you guys do.
Oh, we are a director consumer services platform. We focus primarily on e-commerce. So whether you want to sell your digital content, your merchandise, your tickets, we can take care of all of that. Doesn't matter where you are in the world. We can account to you in 26 different currencies. We're taking money in 26 currencies. And it's not it's not small, not only small bands, and we certainly cater for the small bands, and it's about scale. It's about providing a service that someone who's just starting can use and understand and make their way through it, all the way through to bands that will be selling out arena tours where we're doing all of the tickets. Some of our largest acts will do their own festivals. These are 30,000 capacity festivals, wow, of which we do 100% of the ticketing. And that's, you know, so a band will, you know, when you've got 200,000 people on your website at 9 o'clock on a Friday morning all clicking refresh, we're the guys in the background that actually make that work. So it's a scalable system that's been built up over a long time, and we're built organically. It's not, you know, heavily funded by investors that have various goals and they want to achieve. It's about a group of people that have got the same mentality that we've got to provide the best service possible to our users and learn and grow with them. And yeah, it puts us in a nice position, actually. I think I'm not aware of any other company globally now that can actually do what we can do on such a global scale.
Awesome. Well, good pitch. And you can find it more on musicglue.com. Perfect. Thanks so much. And we got some Spotify news to cover as well today. So a couple of different bits of news. And first up, Spotify's head of European labor relations, Kevin Brown, gave a particularly candid interview last week talking with Music Week about the service's current trajectory and ambitions. So Brown revealed that some of Spotify's label partners have reportedly made more money each month of late from the streaming service than from iTunes. And he predicted that it won't be long until Spotify is generating more money for the music industry than iTunes as a whole, at least when it comes to continental Europe. The Guardian, in the meantime, is reporting that Spotify is approaching the 10 million subscribers mark and that the company is waiting to get to that milestone before announcing any more numbers. And the piece also reports that Spotify has added more than 1 million active users in the UK in the last 4 months, which is a very, very big number. Also off the back on some new partnerships, for example, with The Times here in the UK, and Vodafone as well, the mobile carrier, of course. And the other big bit of news from Spotify is that Daniel Ek announced his partnership with Sprint, and that's something definitely that I want to discuss with you, Chandler. The partnership with Sprint is interesting because even though Daniel Ek in the press conference said that this is the biggest deal we've ever done, there isn't actually a whole lot in the way of discounts for consumers that are subscribing via Sprint. What they get is, if you're an individual consumer, you get 3 months free trial instead of one, and then the pricing is just $9.99. If you are a family, you get 6 months free, and then after that, you pay $7.99 for the first 5 members of the family each per month. And then after 18 months of that, so after 2 years from starting this program, everybody goes back to paying $9.99. And if you are more than 5 members in the family, so 6 or more, then it's $4.99 a month per member of the family. And that also becomes $9.99 per member of the family once the 2 years expire. So it's a very, very expensive proposition. Chandler, do you think that this would drive anybody to subscribe just out of ease? It is much more expensive than Beats Music right now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who aren't using it. I'm surprised at people, and I guess maybe I shouldn't be surprised because I'm living in a in a bubble here. but if it's a checkbox, or you know, if it's really easy to get the trial, I think people would be hooked. I know right. that I sort of skipped the iTunes era. I didn't buy a lot of downloads. I liked physical. I didn't like not owning a physical. So to me, a CD was like a backup copy, and I could rip what I wanted or whatever. Once I signed up to Mog and saw how easy it was to have music at your fingertips, I would probably at the time probably have paid double, you know, $20 a month to have all the music at my fingertips. So for Sprint, I mean, and these bundles with the carriers are huge.
Yeah,
and I think for Spotify to land this, it'll be interesting, because without it, Beats Music and AT&T, you know, it's a new service, but Spotify is a brand name. You know,
exactly. And, yeah. Exactly, and that's kind of like the conclusion I came to, because I made the maths, hoping it's not completely wrong. So essentially, from what I worked out, with Beats Music, a family of five would pay $179.88 per year. On Spotify and Sprint, and that's with the AT&T deal, on Spotify mm-hmm. and Sprint, after the 6 months trial, the cost would be of $479.4 for the year for a family of five, and after the 2 years, it would jump
to $599.4. Wow. which is a lot of money. There is a striking difference here. But also, we have to take into account that Beats Music had to come in with a pricing for AT&T consumers that kind of betrays the importance of that partnership of towards the service actually working out in the end.
Right.
The fact that it's priced so well for families with AT&T really tells you that Beats Music needs that partnership to work out in order for the service as a whole to work. While Spotify's deal is kind of more like we are an established brand, we have tons of users already. We don't really need this deal for the company to succeed. But it's a nice to have thing, so we don't need to really discount it as much. So that's kind of significant, I think, as to the attitude of the two companies and where they are in the process.
Yeah, I think just like Beats Music went with Apple and agreed to the 30% cut, Spotify saying, "Well, we need a deal, but we don't need to give away the store to get this." It's just a matter of it's essentially advertising. They're being advertised in front of the Sprint user base, but if you give away, if the problem with these services is if someone gets used to paying $9.99 a month and then the industry says it's not going to work at $9.99 a month, it needs to be $19.99 a month. it sucks. That's where the freemium model is hard. I see why Beats isn't offering it, although there is, if you sign up for Beats and your trial ends, there's some level of service that you can use.
Like a radio, yeah.
Yeah, so it's hard. Music is everywhere. You can just turn on the radio. You can turn on your cable TV and there's music channels. It's a matter of how much you're willing to pay a month. And before we even get into net neutrality issues where suddenly we're paying extra to our cable companies for different access to Vivo or something like that. So
yeah, absolutely. So we'll see what happens on that front. And also the fact that they are very bullish about surpassing iTunes, it's also a big statement that I think Apple is going to pay some attention to, because although music is not the core of their business anymore, it's certainly something the company's always tried to keep close to its chest. Although, of course, with Steve Jobs passing, he was the real music fan within the company. But I think as a heritage, the company still wants to see music, to be the biggest player in music, but they're going to have to do something drastic to be able to stop the the up-and-coming players in this space. I would like to introduce now my interview at Music Connected with Alan Vitasovic from the company Play MPE, which is based in Vancouver.
Let's explain to our audience, first of all, what Play MPE is, if they don't know anything about it.
Play MPE is a digital delivery system that was created and perfected for music industry needs. Specifically for pre-release distribution of music to radio, press, reviewers, TV sync, music supervisors, DJs, that kind of audience, sending it prior to the actual release date, so it has to be protected. And it was started with that in mind, and it evolved into what it is today.
Yeah, sure. So how did you you have some pretty large clients like Universal, for example, and so how are you expanding the business right now, and how did you get your first clients back in the day?
I'm probably not the best person to talk about that because I joined maybe 5 years ago.
Right.
However, we are used by all three majors, or all four if you still, for nostalgia reasons, like to consider EMI a major label, separate from Universal, probably thousands of independents and independent promoters, pluggers, labels, artists globally in more than 50 countries or territories. The funny thing is, labels know us. We are on the market for more than 10 years, and we have a reputation of a dependable, good company that takes care of our clients and users alike. And a lot of clients come to us without, us having to do much effort. But there's always shows like this, and other events where it's good to go and get people to know us. And
sure, of course. And so technologically, you're pretty much on any device right now available. So you are on Android, iOS, iPad.
That's right. So for the recipients of our content, they primarily access their content from Windows and or Mac computers with our applications, but we also have an option of accessing it from any major browser on any platform, as well as apps for Android tablets, Android phones, iOS apps for iPhone and iPad. We're also launching a BlackBerry app soon. So we're trying to cover most of the platforms that people actually use in the music industry. Maybe up until a few years ago, BlackBerry was kind of a standard. Now it's more on the iPhone side. But it's convenient for them to be able to access the content on the go and, you know, just spend the time that they spend in commute to do a bit of a work. And, you know, it's always good.
And finally, what's it like being based in Vancouver? It's a great tech city, but it's not very well known as a music city. You know, what are the drawbacks there and how have you found being based there?
Well, you know, in today's world, where you physically located, it's not so much important because, you know, the world is a one global community and you can reach your clients and users, you know, easily. And at the other hand, it's fun to travel when you have to go see clients. It's always good to visit other cities. And Vancouver is a great place to live at and to visit.
Awesome. And the website is plaympe.com?
Plaympe.com is the main website. Users also may want to check daily.plaympe.com, which is our portal site for where all the content is announced and where users can see some charts of tracks in our system.
Awesome.
And also our Facebook and Twitter pages.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
There was an interesting report from Billboard that during the F8 developer conference on Wednesday, Facebook introduced a few new tools that were designed to make mobile navigation sharing and advertising a smoother experience while enabling seamless communications amongst third-party apps and Facebook itself. So music was also featured in that presentation, including app developers Spotify, Audio, Vivo, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Mixcloud. And amongst the new features, one of them is called App Links, which is an open-source, open-standards kit that allows apps to link to each other directly. So, for example, you'd be able to direct people from the Spotify app seamlessly into the Songkick app to purchase tickets. There's also a new mobile like button for a third-party app that knocks down a key barrier between the desktop and the on-the-go experience. Then there's and the iOS version is ready now, as a company,
right.
The company promised an Android edition on the way. So this was also demonstrated with Audio by Ime Archibong, the music guy at Facebook, who I actually met in Miami just last month. And finally, Facebook also introduced the Facebook Audience Network, or FAN, which is a mobile advertising platform. So as expected, the company is now allowing third-party developers to embed Facebook advertising within their apps. And of course, that's an interesting thing, because it means that everything can be very targeted to the consumer that has logged into the app itself with Facebook and now can actually get Facebook advertising as well, even though the targeting of those adverts is still a bit shaky considering what the kind of stuff that I'm getting on my feed these days. Still,
yeah.
it's not particularly good yet. And so a lot of stuff happening around Facebook. You know, there's a few other things that were mentioned in the article, but I won't go in depth with it. And so it just seems like the company is really taking a step back from being a front-end player of the music space and really is busy linking up all the other people that are using Facebook for logins and acquiring all that data so it can feed into its graph and become a really powerful tool for advertising. So do you see Facebook moving in a more front and center way into music, or do you think they're just going to be happy to keep this sort of back-end approach and just allow other people to give them data, essentially?
Yeah, I'm curious. I remember when they added the ability to embed sort of streaming service links or whatever, and it was a little annoying. Somebody would embed a Spotify link or an Audio link, and you'd click it, and you couldn't because you didn't have that service or whatever. But
right.
This App Links thing is really useful. The most frustrating thing on an iPhone or any smartphone is clicking on something inside of Facebook and going to the, you know, the mobile website.
Right.
This is similar to what Spotify and Songkick are doing now. They're not, it hasn't rolled out yet, but it's deep linking or direct linking to go from app to app is key to buy a ticket or something. But it'll be interesting to see what Facebook does. I think even though there's a lot of talk about organic reach plummeting, and our news feeds are really Facebook's problem is they're too popular.
Right.
People use it too much. There's too much. People have put too much content on it. But I do think it is a place where some people hang out all day. You know, they're constantly in Facebook, and there's a lot of eyeballs that Facebook could utilize, and the music industry and Facebook could get together and figure out a way to monetize and grab those eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know, right now, I agree. You look at your feed, your Facebook feed, and you're like, you know, it's just a lot of promoted posts and a lot of cat pictures and stuff. So
yeah, that's not great. And also, like, you know, the fact is also laziness on my part. You know, I don't want to give Facebook my information, but and I'd rather, to be honest, for a weird reason, I'd rather give it to Twitter. So if I am presented, I don't know why, it's completely irrational.
I know.
It's completely irrational. But if I'm presented with an app that starts off and it tells me to either register manually, which takes ages, or log in through Facebook or Twitter, I would choose Twitter. But even if it's just Facebook and a manual login, I might just go for Facebook, even if I'd rather not give the app that information and give Facebook the information of what I'm doing on that app, just because I can't be asked to register manually. So I think that's something that most people do.
Well, they have the new anonymous login now. So
I
agree. I defer to Twitter over Facebook, because if you've, for some reason, the alerts that come up in Facebook, it says this app is going to have access to your email, your friend list, your city, and you're like, whoa. And you go over to Twitter, and it's sort of just like, this thing can't post for you.
Yeah.
And maybe they both grab everything. Well, you can on Twitter, your followers are public.
Right, exactly.
Usually, unless if your account's public, your followers are public. And so it's a little less intrusive, I think. So I agree with you. It's similar.
Yeah.
Similar situation.
And if your account is private, I don't think you get Twitter, which it might be a bold statement
to
make, but I still like puzzled by people that have a private account on Twitter. What's the point? And so
I see a few people. I think some people use it in that respect, and that their public or their business would be impacted by their private comments.
Right.
So
of course.
But you know, it's, you know, with gonna say something on Twitter, someone's gonna,
you know,
whatever,
you can also screen grab it or anything, you know, anything can happen. Well, once it's online, you can I think Twitter is the best representation of your online life. The fact that 99.9% of what you do, maybe aside from banking, is probably going to end up somewhere at some point. So you just have to make sure that.
That's true.
Exactly. And now I'd like to introduce my interview with Neil Cartwright from Million Media. It's a real pleasure to be here at Music Connected with Neil Cartwright from Million Media. So hi, Neil. Thanks for joining me. How's it going?
It's going very well. Yeah, really enjoying today. I enjoy this event every time, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It's my third or fourth year, so it's definitely very good. And so I wanted to start by talking about your panel. The panel was called Making Sense of Data and Analytics. So definitely an interesting point that we've seen covered a number of times before at conferences, but it's always interesting to see when you have just an independent panel how they approach that problem. So, what have you seen as sort of the key, you know, conclusions out of the panel today?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think there are any conclusions as such, because the data, as we can see, is ever changing, ever evolving.
Right.
It's about how you. It's. What we didn't get to talk about much today was the sources of data. I think most people know where to get the data. What I think is very difficult to give people in such a short space of time is what to do next.
Exactly.
So you see a spike in sales, or you see that people are using it or watching YouTube. What do you do next? You know, what should you put more videos up? Should you try and advertise? Should you put more releases on there? And I think that really is where, if we'd had more time, I'd really like to have explored a little bit more about the reaction to the data.
Right.
And also the predictions that the data can make. So it's not simply about, oh, well, there's a spike, that was interesting. Yeah. It would be more useful if something could tell you that by doing a certain action, by carrying out an upload or doing a campaign, there will be a spike in the future. And then, oh, great.
Yeah.
And did that spike, was it as big as you thought it would be? Was it smaller? Then you can say, well, did it go wrong somehow? I mean, we could have talked the whole afternoon about data, but I think the room would have emptied.
Yeah, the room. One of the things that was interesting, one of the panelists actually talked about the fact that they felt that there's still not enough aggregation when it comes to data. So, you know, that they felt that there are so many services out there providing data from separate sources. You know, Spotify's got its own platform, and iTunes got iTunes Connect, and you got Google Analytics, and SoundCloud's got their own stats. And it's actually very hard to make sense of it all without bringing it all together. So in that sense, you see there being an expansion of services that provide that kind of thing. Because it's going to be hard to see services that are essentially competitors working together to provide a more consolidated analytics environment.
Well, although the companies like Music Metrics,
right, exactly,
and Next Big Sound, that's essentially what they've been offering to do with various degrees of success, I think. But obviously they charge for that service, and where companies have therefore got to decide, are they going to... are they going to pay for those services, in which case everything is bought into one dashboard and consolidated, and you can start comparing a spike on Facebook with a spike on YouTube because they can overlay all of the different data, or you don't pay and you accept that you're going to have to log into each one of the dashboards separately, or build your own system.
Exactly.
Because a lot of these platforms have APIs, and if you know what an API is, then you can pull that data into your own dashboard and create something for yourself. Not wanting to digress too much, but I think that over the next few years, labels are going to have to start figuring out where they're different, why they're different, what they do that's different, because so many labels use the same solutions at the moment. They have the same dashboards, the same distribution, the same aggregators. And if you're an artist, where's the unique selling point? What do you do better than another label? And labels are going to have to start investing in this technology so that they can say to a manager, we've got the best dashboard, we've got the best distribution, we report more accurately, we report quicker. Because at the moment, everybody is pretty much the same,
yeah,
because they're all going through the same companies.
Exactly. Finally, one of the things that came out of, I don't think it was your panel, but it was the subsequent one, was one of the panelists talked about the fact that a lot of music companies are looking for music-specific solutions, when sometimes actually there are other companies that are doing analytics that are not music-related, but that can actually be very helpful. He talked about Samol as being one of the companies that can provide analytics on your social media stats, for example. So do you think that's something that's overlooked sometimes by the music industry, that is looking for very specific music tools that can actually end up being more expensive or?
Well, Ian, who has set up, is the founder of Audio Salad, used to work at Goldman Sachs.
Right.
And straight after the panel on data, he said to me, oh, you know, Goldman have been obviously aware of the importance of data for years. Obviously, on the trading floor, minute, you know, second delay can potentially cost millions of pounds. And he says the deadlines are absolutely stringent. Things have to be paid by a certain time, otherwise it's huge. So he's come from an industry where data is paramount, where reporting has to be to the penny, it has to be on time, it has to be done to the second. And so he's come into the music industry and is trying to apply the same criteria, the same attention to detail, with the music industry. So absolutely, I think there's a lot we can learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Neil, it was great having you on, and tell us a little bit about Million Media before we go.
Million, I'm getting involved with publishing. I think there's a big revolution to come in publishing and collecting.
Awesome.
more in future talks.
That's great. Cryptic, but good. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Cheers.
And now to a quick Kickstarter overview, as I wanted to point out that the Gramophone campaign, which is going on Kickstarter, which we talked about extensively a couple of episodes ago, is now at $180,000 out of the $250,000 required to fund the project. And with the 13 days left, there's a pretty good chance that the project will get off the ground at this point. And talking about Kickstarter, I wanted to mention Imogen Heap's Mimu Glove project, which is something that escaped my coverage on the show in the past few weeks. Unfortunately, I don't know why I hadn't cottoned on to the fact that it was happening. I knew it was happening, but I just didn't realize it was so late in the campaign. So Heap has been working on the glove for a few years already, and launched the Kickstarter about 28 days ago to fund its leap into a consumer device, or a device that can be produced on a larger scale. So if you check out some of the videos surrounding the glove, it looks like an amazing device that will allow you to control all parts of a track via simple gestures. So fantastic for music making, and will allow you to switch between tasks seamlessly as well, from remixing your voice to operating some sort of MIDI instruments. There's all sorts of controls built into it. Unfortunately, though, it doesn't look like it will reach the £200,000 goal that it set itself, as it has only raised 109 so far, with only 2 days to go. So really, I can't see how they're going to raise, you know, a further £90,000 in 2 days of left of the campaign. This is a real shame, because it's an amazing project. But the price may have put off quite a few people, as a single glove costs £1,200, which in dollars is close to $2,000. So I understand that, because it's an incredibly complex and expensive project to put together with a new technology, cutting edge technology, including textile technology, wearable tech, all sorts of sensors on it. And so the price is justified given the R&D and production costs required. But maybe, Chandler, do you think that this is one of the projects that, due to its complexity, perhaps would have been better handled by finding a manufacturing partner that already does music devices and may have the cash, you know, the $1 or $2 million that may really be required to make this a mass produced device? And maybe Kickstarter for this particularly complex project may not have been the best way to go. But what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think that if she were Neil Young, she might have been successful, just because his, you know, installed user base is bigger.
Yeah.
But this is something that I think crowdfunding is not made for. A complex, expensive product that's hard to explain, and, by, you know, introduced by an artist who's well known but not a household name.
Right.
You know, so that would have been, she probably would have been more successful in shopping it around to an investor, somebody who saw the potential, because it's easier to convince one person about something than what she's trying to do is convince hundreds or thousands of people about something.
Yeah.
Neil Young proved, I think people understood the product, and he's got more people to talk to.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll never buy a Pono, but if it survives a niche market of people who really want high resolution audio and carry around this odd shaped player, that's great. But with her glove, it is fascinating, and I think it will, you know, it'll eventually come to market in a really good way. But crowdfunding is not the way to do it, I don't think.
Exactly. And people on Kickstarter, really, to be honest, if it's a product Kickstarter, they want the product. I mean,
no matter how many
different tiers, you know, she had a lot of tiers that were, you know, lower than, of course, £1,200, which had to do with, you know, all sorts of other merchandise that you could buy around it. But at the end of the day, if you're back in the Mimu glove campaign, unless you're a real, you know, Imogen Heap fan, what you really want is the glove and not a mug or something else that is related to it. And so I think the price was really an issue here, you know. £1,200 is essentially the cost of, is a Google Glass, is it $1,500 right now?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so it even more expensive than Google Glass. So it's definitely a very, you know, it's a niche audience that would like this device, and it's an even more niche audience that would have the money to actually front it and, you know, not receive it for probably, like, you know, 8 months or to a year from paying for it. So yeah, it was a difficult Kickstarter to pull off, but I really do hope, because the team behind it is amazing, I really do hope that it does happen, probably in a different form and with a different partner, some sort of backing financially. But, you know, I would love to see this come to the fore. And finally, you know, the last interview that I wanted to share with you from Music Connected, it's been a very long show, but I really hope you stuck with it, because it was really interesting. It's with Hannah Overton from the Secretly Label Group.
It's good to be here with Hannah Overton, General Manager of Europe for the Secret Legal Label Group. So hi, Hannah, and thanks for joining me. How's it going?
Hello. Very well, thank you.
And so we just finished the panel that was all about sort of how to break an act with under £1,000, which I guess is a very difficult thing to do. And we were chatting about that earlier with another one of the guests. And so what were your main takeaways in terms of, you know, what are the trends as far as an early stage bands and trying to break them? What are the best tools out there?
So I think we came to the conclusion that the best thing to do is to have some, firstly, have some great music, and secondly, have some great content. You also need to be able to find your voice when it comes to social media. So there's a lot you can do without spending any money at all, building up your SoundCloud and your Facebook, your Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram. Start creating your voice using all those tools, and then use the music you've recorded to start creating a following. Yeah. You can put your music on a YouTube channel and on SoundCloud, and start spreading that out and building up your followers that way without spending a penny.
Yeah, sure. So what was your impression of the day today? Where it's the last interview, so I can ask you that. how do you find it?
Yeah, it's been a great day. There's been some great speakers. There's been a lot of talk about how the digital music market is moving, how the streaming market is increasing and what that's doing to digital downloads, how that's cannibalizing them, and a lot of talk about the fact that we're not at the stage yet where streaming income is making up for the lack of physical sales and digital downloads. But at the rate it's increasing, we hope it will get there.
Yeah. And so I love to talk about case studies. So have you got like a particular release that you've worked on over the last few months that has something interesting to share with us in terms of, you know, the way you've worked it?
Secretly Canadian is currently having a lot of success with a band called War on Drugs. Yeah. And actually, I think that is probably a slightly old-fashioned campaign in that the band are on their third album and we feel like this is the album that's taken them from being quite a niche band to going a little bit more overground.
Right.
They've got a lot of fans who really, really love their music. We feel like with this third album, it's really connecting with a new audience. We're getting radio playlists for the first time. Print press has actually really come on board and covered it really well as online. You know, we've been in the album charts for 7 weeks. And that is actually an old-fashioned campaign. I think that proves that you still need to do some of the same things, really. You need to make great music. You need to know how to present it to people. And you need to build your audience through live touring, really.
Yeah, and you were talking about the fact that also if a band has got £1,000 to spend, maybe there's a good sort of argument to make that they should spend some of that or a good part of that in making a decent music video so they can actually get some exposure out of it.
Yeah, and it depends whether you include making videos within your marketing budget, but making videos and content is really, really important. Videos can be put on so many platforms. You know, they can be put on YouTube, which is the second biggest search engine in the world. They can be shared on all your social media. They can be used to present to media to help persuade radio to play your music, to help press to cover your music. So it's just a really good way of putting music in front of people and saying, this is who we are, this is what we do.
Absolutely. And finally, any release that you'd like to plug that's coming out or just about to come out?
Well, we do have an amazing new British band signed to Secretly Canadian. They're called Woman's Hour. They're from Kendal in Cumbria in the northwest, currently based in London, and they make absolutely gorgeous music. They're very, very special, very focused, and have got a great artistic sensibility. Their record's coming out on the 14th of July. They're brilliant live, so yeah, you should all go and check them out. womanshour.co.uk.
That's great. Thanks so much, Hannah. And Chandler, it was a real pleasure having you on the show today. Thanks so much for joining me. Please do share with us anything that you're working on at the moment or that you'd like to plug. We always welcome plugs towards the end of the show and hearing what people are working on.
Well, I guess I've been a long-time listener, first-time caller on this show, and enjoyed your show and learned a lot from the people on there, including Darren and his Daily Digest, Darren Hemmings.
Yeah.
And so it spurred me. Through teaching with Berklee Online, I keep in touch with a lot of the students and found myself sharing stuff individually with them. So his Daily Digest inspired me to start mine. So if anyone is interested, they could go check that out at musicgeekservices.com/subscribe or just musicgeekservices.com and scroll down. It's just sort of, I guess, an American version of what he's doing but what I focus on is mostly, is sort of emerging artists and trying to find things out there, resources, info, tips, articles, how to's on music marketing and sort of, you know, navigating the landscape. Like when Twitter released the new profile design, letting them know these are the specs for the header image and the profile image, that type of stuff, because that's, you know, I find that information on a daily basis, but I realize that not everyone follows all the stuff.
Exactly,
this is sort of like keeping up on Deezer and Beats and all that stuff. So that's what I'm doing.
That's awesome.
In addition to the teaching. So
that's great. And so go and check out the website. It's Geek Music Services.
Oh, it's musicgeekservices.com.
Musicgeekservices.com. Perfect.
Yeah.
And thanks so much for joining me, and thanks so much for listening to this very long and very interesting edition of Digital Music Trends. If you want more information on the Association of Independent Music, you can visit musicindie.com, which is their website, and you'll find all the information about the independent scene in the UK. It's a great association if you are in the UK to join for the independent music industry. And if you enjoyed the show, please do share it around. We welcome embedding or all sorts of types of sharing, to be honest. There's no qualms around it on my end. And you can also subscribe to DMT's newsletter. Again, you can visit digitalmusictrends.com, or you can go on bit.ly/DMTlist to subscribe. And I will send one email a week just to let you know what the latest shows are, so you don't miss out in case you're not keeping up to date with a podcatcher or anything like that. And any other feedback, you can direct to @DigiMusicTrends on Twitter or on contact@DigitalMusicTrends.com. Next week, the show is also going to be delayed by a few hours, probably going to come out on a Thursday night or Friday morning, as it's being recorded live from the stage of The Great Escape in Brighton. So very excited about that, and hopefully it's going to turn out great, and it's going to be up on Thursday night, Friday morning, GMT time, so sometimes on midday Thursday for the US or a late night. Thanks so much for listening. Have a fantastic week, and until next time.